Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra concludes its season with a program titled Musical Fireworks Saturday night at the Performing Arts Center, featuring Handel's music for the Royal Fireworks, Haydn's Trumpet Concerto featuring principal trumpeter Tim McFadden, and Béla Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra. My guest today is freelance conductor Alistair Willis, who returns to the orchestra this week. Willis has held assistant posts with the Cincinnati and Seattle Symphony Orchestras and has been a guest conductor with many orchestras, including the Chicago Symphony, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the New York Philharmonic. He's received a Grammy nomination for his 2009 recording of Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors and Ravel's L'Enfant et le Sortilège with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra when he stepped in at the last minute after music director Kenneth Skimmerhorn died. He was Yo-Yo Ma's conductor for the Silk Road performances during their Far East and North American tour, and his next appearance after Saturday night's concert will be with the Qatar Philharmonic in the Middle East. Well, he'll lead the TSO in Handel, Haydn, and Bartók Saturday night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. He joins us today as our guest on Studio Tulsa. Alistair Willis, welcome back to Tulsa, and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be back with you, Rich.
Yeah. Season finale for Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, a program called Musical Fireworks, and you're playing Royal Fireworks music, but you know the Bartók is sort of musical fireworks of its own.
Oh, absolutely. Fireworks from the start. It's basically a five-movement symphony, but he called it a concerto for orchestra because he treats each of the players soloistically, if you will. So whereas you'd expect fireworks from the principal players in a section, principal trumpet, principal oboe, they get fireworks, but so does the second oboe, the second bassoon, the third bassoon, the second trumpet, and everyone has a great part to play, and everyone loves playing this piece.
Is it one you enjoy conducting?
Oh, I love conducting.
What is special about conducting a piece
well,
like this?
Well, I've always liked Bartók, and I studied this piece for many years before I conducted it for the first time, and I'm fortunate to have had some great mentors in this piece, which included Ivan Fischer, the conductor
Budapest.
Of the Budapest,
yeah.
And he knows his Bartók, my goodness. Christoph Eschenbach, who knows his Bartók as well, and I studied this piece with him when he conducted it with the Houston Symphony in his final year there as music director, which was when I was also at Rice University in Houston. I studied this at Tanglewood with Bob Spano. I've heard great, great conductors conduct this over the years, and it's all formed and keeps forming. This is, I think, my fifth or sixth performance with this piece, and each time it just gets deeper and deeper. I find new things. It's just an incredible piece. It's so organized. And there's so much in it.
A lot of people will talk about the math that's in it. You know, the golden ratio that's sort of a part of it. Is that something you think of as a conductor?
So I have to think about it. But one of the first things I do with a new score, not that this is new, but I always analyze a piece. And I see the relations. If we go with a classical piece of music like the Haydn Trumpet Concerto, it's quite simple where you have your introduction, your exposition, your development, your recapitulation. And I can do this pretty much on a plane with a piece of music without having
the other movements are song forms.
Song form and quite straightforward. But when you get into the 20th century and beyond, it's some of the forms are just a bit more complicated and the notes what go with it. And to see the structure of a piece, just to get the big picture. And Bartók was a genius with big picture.
And, you know, and this is the thing about it is there's math in this piece, but hearing it, you would never know it.
I would never know it. Maybe somebody might hear it first time.
You know, I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's written into the piece, but it's something you're going to have to do a little bit of research just to figure out where it is in the score, for example.
Right. And I wonder what it would be like to be in the audience and hear this for the first time. I'm sure there'd be some first-time listeners and what they make of it. Because some of it is a bit challenging, but some of it is immediately graspable. But the bottom line is this is one of the 20th century top pieces ever played and programmed still to this day. There's got to be something about it which has kept it in the repertoire.
And of course, you have this beautiful, glorious finale of the piece, but you also have every sort of musical construct of the 20th century that's sort of a part of this piece. You know, there's quotes from Shostakovich, which was sort of, I understand that was a bit derisive, maybe. It was It was not a happy joke. It was kind of like, you know, giving him a bum's rush of some sort in the piece. You have the second movement that is the
Game of Pairs.
Game of Pairs. Now, first time hearing this, this might totally escape you.
Right.
The fact that each woodwind section, the two players are playing in parallel motion and everything from thirds, fifths, seconds to sevenths.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and,
exactly.
And, you know, it is a genius of orchestration.
It is.
Totally. And it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. Of the five movements, two are dark and three are lighter. And the two darker ones are the first and the third. But as you mentioned, the last movement is a tour de force of moto perpetuo, of joy and dance and fun and great rhythms and incredible composition. The fourth movement has the fun. It has some melancholy in it, I think, in the fourth movement. But this interruption, it's called Intermezzo Interrotto, which is just an incredible joke which comes out, which we'll go into in a sec. But the second movement, again, is a scherzo. It's fun. So in a way, he's looking at past forms, taking them, but making them his own and expanding them. I don't think, if we start with the second movement, I don't know of an example, there might be one, but I don't know of an example where a composer has done this before. He takes the pairs of instruments and has them play together, each in contrary motion with different intervals. It is really genius. It's kind of like, as I think about it, it's the Noah's Ark of music. The two instruments come in two by two, and it's all presided over by one snare drum who keeps it all together, and the form, again, is great, and how he has them play, then at the middle chorale, then they come back at the end, slightly different, as you would expect, with a bit more, few more flourishes. It's a genius of composition.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the second movement. This is the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, second movement. What is it called?
The Game of Pairs.
Game of Pairs is the second movement, and it will be played by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night in their season finale, Musical Fireworks. My guest is guest conductor Alistair Willis, as we hear music from Bartok. That's music of Béla Bartók from the Concerto for Orchestra, The Game of Pairs. And Alistair Willis is my guest. He's guest conducting that. And it is, as we heard, just a happy movement. It's a typical scherzo.
Very witty, yeah.
And then you go to that third movement. How do you prepare for a change like this? And of course, these are all played without pause for the most part.
Oh, there's a little bit of pause between them.
Yeah.
They don't say attacca between.
Yeah.
Some conductors do that, and that's a taste thing. But I only attacca the third to the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't want to give anything away here, but I do take my time to set up the third, which I think is necessary because it is such a contrast. It needs a different mindset to conduct.
You've got
this.
A little bit of folk music, Hungarian sort of music, and that's another sort of musical statement he's making in this piece.
Absolutely. For me, the third, I heard one conductor say that the third movement starts almost as darkly as the first movement does. There's a connection there with the low instruments, the basses starting, and that the third movement could represent midnight in Budapest during the war. Imagine this bleakness, this shell-shocked city, this the sadness, the terror, the fear that is going on. And he conveys this with all sorts of night music. He wrote a lot of, he's famous for his night music in his other music, in his other pieces, and this has a lot of night music feel to it. It's quite eerie, it's quite sad, it's quite powerful. And it's very dramatic, and you can't really go from the second to the third quite too quickly.
The fourth movement you were talking about earlier has this beautiful oboe melody, and then all of a sudden it's almost like, a band comes crashing down the street and barges into the auditorium almost.
Yeah, the story that I've been told that goes with that is that, as we know, Bartok was ill when he wrote this, and he was in his hospital bed in New York. He was living in America at the time. And outside of his hospital window, everyone on the streets was whistling the march theme from Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony.
Well, that tells you how times have changed.
Oh, hasn't it? Does exactly. They'd be listening to it on their iPods these days. But outside, and he would hear this on the streets. This is what was keeping the war effort going and the revolution moving forward and lifting the spirits of the people. But this must have been, for a composer, absolute torture to hear somebody else's music, a piece that he didn't like and he heard probably sung and whistled very wrong, is my guess. So after this beginning beautiful oboe melody, as you mentioned, and a lovely viola melody that would follow, just full of nostalgia, I think, there's an interruption. And we hear, bursting into the scene, this melody from Shostakovich 7, which he pastiches. It doesn't write it exactly as Shostakovich did. But right before this, the two biggest interruptions given to the, I think these could be perhaps either the rudest orchestral sound known to man. The two trombonists really sort of play two raspberries, if you will, which I think really let us know what Bartok thought of Shostakovich's music at the time. But then again, the structure, he ends back with this, he comes back to this viola melancholy melody and ends with the oboe melody. Mm. And it sort of takes you through the sort of A, B, C, B, A, if C is the interruption.
Now, you said you studied this piece with Ivan Fischer, Christoph Eschenbach, and Bob Spano, among others. Are they all sort of on the same page with this piece, or does each of them have their own sort of insights? And as a young conductor, you say, oh, well, that kind of goes against what this person says. What do I do?
Oh, that's such a great question, because my training is so full of contradictions. You know, being in a conducting masterclass, you know, we're told to come prepared and be convinced of what we're gonna do. So we show up, we're prepared, and we conduct as convincingly as we can, only to be yelled at. No! Try it this way. You know, by the main person. It's like, well, what do you do?
That is such a masochistic exercise. It's basically tell you to have your convictions, and then when you state your convictions, they're all wrong.
Exactly right. And so there have been some contradictions that I've seen in the great conductors. I'm not going to point those out to them, am I?
Right.
And but what I admire from especially the older masters, let's say, is how they've lived with the piece, how they see beyond the notes. Of course, the first job from the conductor is, of course, to make sure we're playing the right notes and playing the right balances and rhythms, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, there's a feeling. I like to put myself as best I can into Bartok's shoes at the beginning of that first movement. Imagine myself in that hospital bed near death.
You're in a strange country.
And I'm a strange country. I'm not liking the environment or the music that I'm hearing outside my window. And I'm struggling to rouse myself into some kind of artistic expression. And this, of course, happened thanks to Serge Koussevitzky, the conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, who he and a few friends thought that if they offered this commission to Bartok, it would improve his health. And it did. It worked. And his health did get better. And he composed this piece within a few months, this masterpiece within a few months. It's remarkable, that part of the story. And we see this transformation as we go through the piece. But to have the orchestra feel, first of all, to feel the mood, the times, perhaps really try to get into what Bartok is saying beyond the notes, then for me to convince an orchestra of that, and then for us together to convince the audience. And it's this journey, it's a very powerful a piece, and we can feel all together these incredible emotions and experiences together.
My guest today, Alistair Willis, who will be conducting the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in their season finale, Musical Fireworks, a program featuring Handel, Haydn, and Bartok, a concerto for orchestra. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, an orchestra the size of Tulsa, a regional orchestra, the concerto for orchestra comes around, you know, maybe once every 5, 6, 7 years, as opposed to a major orchestra that might perform it every year. So it's a great experience for the players. Mm-hmm. The other part of your program is music they are very familiar with, you know, the Royal Fireworks music of Handel and Haydn's Trumpet Concerto, which they probably played numerous, numerous times. There's one approach I would think you would take with the Bartok, where this is a special piece of music. How do you get that, you know, I mean, they're professionals and all, but is there a different approach you take for music that they know very, very well?
Well, I actually have exactly the same approach. All pieces are special. Yeah. And the Handel and the Haydn are unbelievably special and just as groundbreaking in their own right. If we can transport ourselves back to 1749 and then in the early 18, a few years later when Haydn wrote his Trumpet Concerto, I don't know the exact date, these pieces just were were groundbreaking. I mean, Handel, his life, of course, he was German, but he became English, shall we say. And
just like their kings and queens.
and he really was known as an opera composer. He was the king's, the court composer there. He was asked to do all the most important things by the end of his life, including composing music for special occasions, and this was a special occasion. I mean, what an honor to compose a piece for the peace treaty of the War of the Austrian Succession. And the story behind this, as everyone knows, is remarkable, and we take that story into the piece with us as we play it, and I invite the audience to do that too. It was an outdoor concert. Handel had scored it for a full orchestra, but the king didn't like strings. He only wanted wind instruments. So Handel had to comply, as rightly he did, and struck the strings from the first performance. He put them in the second performance a month later, which was indoors, and there were no fireworks. But the fireworks in this outdoor performance, you know, one went awry and set the tent on fire, and there was a stampede. People were crushed, and the music seemed to create a more lasting impression than the fireworks did. But one of the geniuses about this... Handel was a bit unsure about having an open rehearsal, meaning open to the public, as many orchestras do these days. But I guess he didn't have a choice because it was an open-air music and they had to rehearse it in the open, and he had this huge orchestra there. Anyway, it was one of the best PR stunts he ever did because everybody wanted to come and hear. There were traffic jams everywhere on every bridge, and people got to hear this music, and what a great PR stunt.
Yeah, right. And the original orchestration is just... I would love to hear it sometime in the original orchestration because what is it, like 18 oboes?
24 oboes.
24 12 oboes.
12 bassoons.
12 bassoons.
I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. It was just because it was all winds, no strings, and of course, no amplification in those days. So you had to have, there were no clarinets or flutes, I don't think, on the program.
Right.
It was just double reeds and brass. Mm-hmm.
And some conductor friends of mine, in fact, one of my, I would say my Baroque conducting mentor these days is Nicholas McGeegan. I'm not a real expert in Baroque music, so when I do Baroque music, I go to people who know. And he tells me that he does this several times a year with fireworks. And so he's conducting on a click track to make sure that he's staying with the tempo because before the fireworks are timed to go off at specific moments in the music. And staying with that is quite hard, and because the sound and the sights and everything. So I'm very grateful we're doing an indoor performance here in Tulsa. And the fireworks will only be coming from the stage and not from any tent that's going to catch fire.
Now, I think that might surprise people that, you know, there are Baroque specialists who basically, I mean, a lot of this wasn't written down, and it's been involved in scholarship, and really the traditions were lost for some time. I mean, when you listen to a Baroque performance, say, in the early part of the 20th century, it is nothing like a Baroque performance today from a specialist.
Right.
What are some of the things that Baroque specialists are doing that had become lost?
Well, again, as I've just admitted, to answer that properly, I can't do, but I can give in a sense from what I learned. Last week, I was in Seattle at home, and I went to the Seattle Baroque Orchestra and heard a concert from them. And I was blown away. I was transported to another world, a world that I don't often go to because I just don't conduct this music so much. They were playing on period instruments, so they tune slightly lower than we do.
Tuning would be different, and the sound would be different.
Yeah. No vibrato. These are slightly smaller bow for the strings, and the overall sense was one of such purity. The acoustics in the concert was just amazing, and I left thinking I've got to experience more of this. This is such an uplifting experience to hear these players make such a pure sound together. Yes, they used a bit of vibrato, but not much. The colors and the shades were all. Were all done by them. As we get into Bartok, he writes crescendo, forte, accents, and gives us instruction, as most modern composers do. But back then, you just had the notes. You have to make the music yourselves. And to that end, all the Baroque conductors that I know today, they mark the parts. They put in those crescendos, those expression markings that perhaps modern composers do naturally today.
Mm-hmm.
Because not every orchestra is trained like a Baroque orchestra to find that music naturally and automatically. So I got some help with that on every Baroque piece that I do from Nick and other people. And And so my parts, if you were to look at them, that the players are playing from, have some penciling in and show a dynamic that people want to know these days. You know, how loud? Is it mezzo forte, mezzo piano? There's a difference, and we want to know. Mm-hmm. And because this is not the total staple of of a large symphony orchestra, we need to do what we can to try and simulate as best we can these kind of practices.
So you try to create that sort of intimacy, but again, these are modern instruments. They
right.
sound different.
Right.
And, you know, really, a modern orchestra can't imitate that Baroque orchestra.
Well, we're not going to try and sound like the Baroque players of London or of Vienna. We're not trying to do that, but we can make sure that it doesn't sound like the Bartok or Rachmaninoff. and these are important steps to take, and that's why we rehearse. And the first rehearsal last night was very exciting.
All right. Also on the program, Tim McFadden doing double duty. Now, this is a trumpet-heavy program. I assume he's having some help, at least at some point, because he's playing the soloist in the Haydn concerto.
Well, Tim is so amazing. He doesn't need help, but I think he is getting some. I don't think he's playing the – in fact, he's not playing the Handel, the first piece. So he'll come in fresh for the Haydn trumpet concerto, but he is playing the Bartok in the second half.
Yeah. And this is a great piece, too.
Oh, I was a trumpeter. I threatened to Tim that I would bring my trumpet in today and play some excerpts and pretend that it was him, which of course I wouldn't do, and I no way could I ever play as well as he does. He's a remarkable player, and just to have him play this piece and for me to be a trumpet player and to know the piece so well, it's going to be a great collaboration. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, as a trumpet player knowing this piece intimately, you know, you've probably played it at one point. And this is a piece you know intimately, but what's really special about the Haydn trumpet concerto, besides the fact it's probably one of the first?
Well, right. I studied this piece when I was learning the trumpet with some of the top London teachers and performers at the time, and so I picked up several things before Google came along, where you can find them much quicker. And the trumpet back in the Baroque time was very limited. It could only play in the high register. It didn't have any valves. It was just what we call a natural trumpet or natural horn. You change the pitches by using your embouchure, your lips and your tongue and the pressure of how you blow.
And they would play high because that's the partials get back to math again.
Right.
It gets closer the higher you go. Right.
Exactly. So if you think of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto, some of the high stuff in there was possible because as high you go, you didn't need valves. Now all of a sudden, the court trumpeter in Vienna called Anton Weidinger, he invented this keyed, this holed trumpet that could play a scale in the lower register. Now, that hadn't been possible before. And one can only wonder how crass it might have sounded, because he was ahead of his time. Only 20, 30 years later did valves become were invented and became slowly part of the orchestra outfit. And so on this primitive instrument that Mr. Weidinger invented, who Haydn wrote this concerto for, I'm sure it wasn't as pretty as we can play it, how we can play it today, but it was groundbreaking to hear a trumpet play not just high, but low. There's so much wit in Haydn's music. Every now and then there'll be a melody in the middle register, which was not available before, and then he'll put in yum ba ba bum 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 down in the low register as if to say, ha, 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 this is what I can do, and no other trumpet could do it before me. and knowing these inside things are so fantastic and bring the piece alive. And what with Haydn's already established classical wit as a composer and with his form, it's incredible.
You have to remember that you have composers into the middle of the next century still writing for natural trumpet.
That's right. It took a lot of the conservative composers among them. I don't think that the valved trumpet became commonplace until the second half of the 19th century, even though it had been around before. But Haydn was still way above this in the end of the 18th century.
It's kind of interesting. You know, he always wrote for unusual. You know, he wrote how many pieces for the baritone? You know, so I guess he was always looking for a new instrument to write for.
He found the inspiration. He was always looking for an inspiration, and his concertos are incredible. But really, this I think the most special of all of his concertos is this trumpet, given the history behind it, given how groundbreaking it was, and how it really helped shape and form what the trumpet could do and how future composers could go with it.
It sounds like a great program, Musical Fireworks. My guest today is Alistair Willis, a guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in their season finale. Now, you are continue to be a very busy guest conductor, a busy schedule. You're going back to Nashville. Of course, you had the Grammy nomination a couple of years ago for the, Ravel's Enfant de la Sorte.
That's right, yeah.
And that's kind of unusual for a guest conductor to be leading an orchestra on a recording.
Well, yeah, that is unusual. And it was, I guess you could say, it was just very fortunate how that came by. When I was invited to do that recording, it was just a concert performance of opera. It eventually went into a recording, but I wasn't initially engaged to do that. And a few months before I showed, I was invited, the music director, Kenneth Skirmerhorn, passed on tragically and unexpectedly. And they were finding themselves in a music director search. And so my engagement turned into a recording, which probably the music director would have done. Mm-hmm. And so it worked out for me in their moment of not having a music director to step in there and to step up. And it was such an incredible experience. At the Grammy Awards, I remember chatting with Alan Valentine, the executive director, and saying, well, Alan, any chance I could come back and do another recording? And he said, absolutely not. And I said, excuse me? He said, well, by then they'd named their music director, and it's really the music directors that need to make the recordings with their orchestras.
That's now, what gives the orchestra, prestige.
Right, and I can't argue with that. And Giancarlo Guerrero, the music director, has had a few Grammy nominations and won a few Grammys since then, and that's fantastic. That's how it should be. Congratulations to them. So I asked Alan, well, any chance of me coming back in guest conducting again? And he said, absolutely, yes. And that's going to happen next month.
We've talked last time, I think, about your experience with the Silk Road, which is this great amalgam of East and West with Yo-Yo Ma. That had to be a great experience as far as just experiencing a different type of music on a night-in and night-out basis, and sort of almost classical music the way it was 200 years ago when it was the sort of the center of attention. Would you agree?
I would totally agree. It's, for a start, working with Yo-Yo Ma is a highlight of anyone's career. Not just a great musician, but a great person and a great ambassador for music or anything he puts his name to. And the people that he handpicks from around the world, from different cultures, different countries, different instruments that I've never heard of, let alone know how they even make a sound on them, and to bring them together into an incredible fusion of new and old, centuries old, but sometimes brand new music coming together and collaborating and showing harmony within cultures, countries, and on the concert stage. It's just a winner of a package.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a great program for this weekend. You've got a little bit of Baroque, you've got a little classical music in Haydn's trumpet concerto, and then the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. Sounds like a fitting close to the season. We look forward to it. Alistair Willis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Alistair Willis is the guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's program titled Musical Fireworks, featuring Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks, Haydn's Trumpet Concerto, and Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. The concert takes place tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Call 918-596-7111 for ticket information or visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org or subscribe to the Studio Tulsa podcast at the iTunes Store. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.